afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. Excuse me, I was too far from the microphone, I think. We are live for an hour each weekday afternoon, and we take your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, we'd be glad to have you call in. If you differ from the host on any subject, you're welcome to call in also. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Now, all week I've been making this announcement. This is my last chance to make this particular one. Tomorrow morning in, is it Tecumseh, Oklahoma, we have a meeting. I think it's in a home, and then it's followed by lunch. It's open to those who wish to come. You can RSVP and get directions to the place by calling a number at our website. Then the next day, in the evening, I'm going to be in Albuquerque, New Mexico, speaking again. And then Monday and Tuesday, I'll be in the Phoenix area. Three locations in the Phoenix area. I'll be in Buckeye, in Peoria, and Maricopa for different meetings. And if you'd like to join us there, we'd be glad to have you there if you're in the Phoenix area. So, Oklahoma City area, I guess, Albuquerque, and the Phoenix area the next few days. If you live in those areas and would like to attend one of those gatherings, feel free to go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, thenarrowpath.com. Look under announcements, and you'll look up the dates, and you'll see the contact information. In each of those cases, you're going to want to call somebody for directions. But that's what they're willing to hear from you. So, I guess that's all the announcements I have to make. Let's go to the phones and talk to David from Camarillo, California. David, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. How's everything? I just wanted to put it out there that I'm a Seventh-day Adventist. I call you frequently sometimes. Mm-hmm. Not that much, though. But my question that I have for you today is, what was Jesus' name prior to his incarnation?
Well, the Bible refers to him as the Word prior to his incarnation.
But that was not his name prior to the incarnation.
Well, we're not given a name for him. If you want me to say Yahweh or Jehovah, because we do believe that Jesus is the incarnate of the Father, and well, it says in Colossians 2:9 that in him dwelt all the fullness of the Godhead bodily. So the whole Godhead incarnate in him is what Paul said Jesus was. So
yeah,
the God that he incarnated is Yahweh. But some people would say the angel of the Lord, who is in the Old Testament, is a reference to Christ. That
Michael.
Can't be. Well, no, that's not what they'd say. They'd say when you read of the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament, they'd say that's a reference to a theophany or a Christophany, Christ appearing. Now, there are people who believe, and I guess you're one of them, that Michael the archangel was a name for Jesus. We don't have very many references to Michael in the Bible. He is the only angel in the Bible that's called an archangel, which could mean the chief angel, or it could mean the chief of the angels. So,
correct.
And the name Michael means who is like God. So there are some people who say, and I'm assuming you're one of them, that Michael represents Jesus. Now, you say, of course. I'm not sure why it would be of course. I don't really see it as an obvious thing, but some people do make that identification.
Well, when Jesus returns, he's coming with the voice of the archangel.
True.
He's not coming with the voice of somebody else. He's coming with the voice of the archangel. So that would, in my mind, is a very plain reference to the fact that when Jesus returns, he's returning as the archangel, the voice of the archangel.
Well, it doesn't say he's coming as the archangel. He's coming with 10,000s of his saints, which may include angels. It would seem very strange wording to say he's going to come with his own voice. I mean, his voice could be mentioned, but I wouldn't imagine that if Paul's talking about somebody coming, that, and there's going to be a voice accompanying him, that he'd say, oh, he's coming with his own voice. He might. I mean, I'm not opposed to it, because, I mean, people who are opposed to it are those who say, well, wait, Jesus isn't an angel, he's God. Well, they don't understand, I think, that the word archangel could mean the chief of the angels, and the chief of the angels could certainly be God, as when in Joshua chapter 6, Joshua ran into somebody who identified himself as the captain of the Lord's hosts, which would be the captain of the angels, and most Christians believe that's a reference to Christ. But I don't have a I don't have a dog in that fight.
Well, the way it's worded in 1 Thessalonians 4:16, it says, "For the Lord Himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel."
Mm-hmm.
So that implies to me that the archangel is the Lord.
Well, if that's what it sounds like to you, I can't dissuade you of that, nor would I care to. I would point this out, though. In Jude verse 9, it says when the archangel Michael debated with Satan over the body of Moses, he didn't dare to bring a railing accusation against Satan, but rather said, "The Lord rebuke you." Now, if you think that Jesus, prior to his incarnation, was no more superior to Satan than to not dare to bring a railing accusation against him, then I would say you probably have a lower view of Jesus before his incarnation than I think the Bible teaches.
Michael the archangel obviously didn't dispute with the devil.
No, it says he did. It says he did, yeah, in Jude verse 9. Maybe you should look that up and call me again on that. We got a lot of calls waiting, so I think you're perhaps unprepared for that. So look it up and call me back sometime. Our next caller is our atheist friend Max from Portland. Hi, atheist friend Max. How you doing?
Hello, Christian radio host friend Steve. I hope you're doing well, and I hope
I'm well, thanks.
Are you still on the road?
Yes, I'm in, where am I? Arkansas.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, I grew up near I spent time down in the Ozarks. Hey, I wanted to ask you a question about sort of a theme that certainly a lot of your audience seems to be interested in. And in taking a look at the things that you've written, the books that you've written, it seems to be sort of a theme with your material as well. And that is the end of the world. And this debate between preternaturalism and partial preternaturalism and eschatology and all that. I'm just really curious to know why you think there seems to be such a focus on this, why there's a lot of talk about the apocalypse there seems to be. Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't have a tremendous focus on it myself, but you're right, lots of callers are concerned about it. I think that many people are probably alarmed at the rapid changes that are happening in the world around them, and they think that some of these changes are inexplicable, unless it is perhaps, you know, a unique time, such as never been before, and they feel like perhaps this is the end times. They might feel that, you know, with the way things are going, you know, the world can't go very much longer without society deconstructing or whatever. I mean, I think people just have a general, foreboding about the time we're in. And then I think everybody is always curious if they believe in the end of the world, if they believe in the second coming of Jesus. I think every Christian's always curious, you know, when will Jesus come back? And then there's, of course, the fact that many people interpret certain passages in a way that encourages them to see this as the end of the world. One of the popular views that's out there that a lot of Christians hold is that the coming of Israel back together as a nation in 1948 was kind of a predicted end times sort of a thing. At one time, before the years got as advanced as they are now, it was argued that Jesus would have to come within the generation that saw Israel become a nation. There were some teachers, popular teachers, teaching that. And they thought, therefore, Jesus would have to come back within about 40 years after 1948. Obviously, doing the math, you can see that they missed their calculations. But some people still feel that Israel becoming a nation in 1948 was a significant marker of the end times. And so, I suppose those are some of the main reasons. Besides that, Christians usually believe that when Jesus comes back, there's going to be a generation of Christians alive at the time who won't have to die. Jesus will raise the dead ones, but those who haven't died yet will, without dying, be caught up to meet the Lord in the air. And I think a lot of people kind of like the idea of not dying. So it's very common for people to, you know, hope, maybe try to convince themselves that we are living in that generation that won't necessarily all die.
Is that healthy, do you think, as a follower of Christ, to sort of have that be one of your be a focus, be a concern?
I don't think it's necessarily that healthy. I think a lot of people.
Me neither.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who are convinced that, you know, that prophecy is being fulfilled and Jesus must come soon will become disillusioned if he does not. And I saw this happen back in 1970 when there was a book that sold tens of millions of copies, a best-selling book called The Late Great Planet Earth by a popular author named Hal Lindsey. And he and many well-known prophecy teachers were arguing that, you know, in 1970 that we were very, very near the end and gave the impression that some of us, you know, that we might not expect to be around much more, maybe not more than a year or two. And Hal Lindsey very specifically said that the rapture of the church would have to occur before 1981, which was, you know, within a decade of the time he was writing. But, of course, in his mind, it could happen any time before that, too. So a lot of people who had not otherwise been interested in Christianity became convinced by what they thought was the fulfilling of prophecy that Jesus was coming soon. I think a lot of people wanted to get their ticket to heaven and went to, you know, professed to be Christians. And then when Jesus didn't come back, it was a little bit like the boy that cried wolf. You know, they said, well, these people don't know what they're talking about. And they really, you know, they just got discouraged. So I think there's the danger of that. If people are living their life with the assumption that, you know, their life is going to be interrupted by the second coming of Christ any moment, well, if that doesn't happen, and so far in 2,000 years it has not happened, I think they stand to be disillusioned. But, of course, a person can believe in the second coming of Christ, as I do, without taking any position about how near or far it might be. As far as I'm concerned, it might not come in my lifetime at all, or my children's or my grandchildren's. So you don't live your life with the idea that you're not going to get anything done because Jesus is coming too soon, because no one knows when he's going to come. And everyone who has thought previously that he was coming soon happened to be mistaken. And many of them had done a lot of calculations. I mean, they picked some numbers out of Daniel, some numbers out of Revelation, maybe a few of them out of Leviticus.
Can I ask a specifically biblical question? Isn't there a passage in the New Testament where Jesus is reputed as saying to his disciples that some of you here shall not taste death until the Son of God returns or something?
He did say some of you standing here will not taste death before you see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And he also said in another place, this generation will not pass before all these things take place. Now, the passages where he said that, in my opinion, he was predicting the destruction of Jerusalem, which occurred in 70 AD when the Romans came and destroyed the temple. In the second of those two cases in particular, Jesus had predicted at the beginning of the chapter in Matthew 24, verse 3, or actually verse 2, Jesus had predicted that the temple would be destroyed and that not one stone would be left standing on another. And in verse 3, the disciples asked him about that.
Hadn't the temple been previously sacked by the Romans, I think, during the Maccabean revolt? Hadn't that happened prior to Jesus?
No, the temple had been destroyed once before in 586 B.C. by the Babylonians.
Okay.
Now, the Maccabean revolt happened in around 168 B.C., and the temple was desecrated, but not destroyed.
At least twice in previous history, the temple had been desecrated or destroyed, and Jesus was predicting that maybe the political climate of the time about to be crucified himself by the political and religious climate of the time, that might happen again. You don't think that could have been just a prediction?
Well, the temple had only been destroyed.
It had already happened previously.
Right. It had happened 600 years earlier, right. One time 600 years earlier,
right.
The temple had been destroyed. What happened before the Maccabean revolt was not the destruction of the temple, but simply that a tyrant sacrificed a pig in the temple, which made the Jews feel like they couldn't use it again until they cleansed it. But the destruction of the temple in 70 AD was very, very much like the events of 586 BC. But Jesus didn't say it might happen. He said, "Verily, I say to you," which is a way of saying this is absolutely true, "this generation will not pass before these things happen." And he specifically said, not one stone of the temple would remain standing on another. And that happened. I mean, someone could say,
except for the Wailing Wall.
That's not part of the temple. The Wailing Wall is a retaining wall of the Temple Mount. So it's holding up dirt. Yeah, it's holding up
the mountain.
So it's
the foundation of the temple. Right. Can I ask one more question? As I'm sure you have many anxious callers who probably want to discuss this topic. I grew up, again, evangelical, and I was a big fan of the Left Behind series, both the adult version and you say I can hear it in your voice, so Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins, and the young adult series. My question is, regarding the temple in Jerusalem, do you believe that it's going to be rebuilt one day, and is it going to be the Antichrist that rebuilds it? And do you think that the temple will be rebuilt and that'll be either a sign of the end of the times, as you, I assume, alluded to the recreation of Israel as a state? What are your thoughts on the rebuilding of the temple? What would that sign foretell?
Well, the people who are all excited about the end times usually are expecting the temple to be rebuilt in Jerusalem. And they do expect it to be a project sponsored by the Antichrist. Now, this is what we call the dispensational view. I'm not a dispensationalist, so I don't actually know of any verse in the Bible that predicts a third temple. The temple was destroyed in 70 AD, was the second temple, built after the Babylonians had destroyed Solomon's temple. So many people, almost everybody who talks about the end times a lot, believes that there's going to be a third temple. They believe the Antichrist will, as it were, be ruling the world and giving permission to the Jews to build it. And then they think he'll desecrate it. In my opinion, there's nothing in the Bible that predicts this. Now, do I think there will be a third temple? Well, if the Bible predicted it, I'd have to say yes. Since the Bible doesn't, in my opinion, predict it, I can only say it might. I don't believe it's a predicted thing, and I don't think it's necessarily related to end times prophecy, but I do believe that the Jews, some Jews in Israel, are interested in rebuilding the temple if they get the opportunity. So I would not say they won't. I would just say if they do, I don't believe it fulfills any particular prophecy. All right. Hey, I'm going to take another call now, Max, but I appreciate
you joining us. Thank you so much, Steve. Thank you so much, Steve.
All right. Thanks
for calling.
Thank
you so much, Steve. I appreciate your time. Thank you. Have a good one.
All right. Bye now. Okay, let's talk to Gil from New York, New York.
Hey.
Gil. Hi.
Hey, Steve. It's a pleasure and a treasure to get on the program. I don't know if you remember me. Of course you're going to remember me. I'm the blind caller that suffers from ringing in the ears for a long time. and you said you seemed very understanding when I told you about it. I was talking about Calvinism before, and I did listen to your stuff on the computer that you told me to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question, okay? I, of course, play music on the keyboard. I taught myself because I have very bad ringing in my ears. Doctor says nothing they can do for me, and that's how I learned how to play the keyboard. That's how I got saved. In Colossians 3:16, it says, "Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord," right? Here it says spiritual songs. I'm in a church that believes that, you know, like a lot of contemporary Christian music is worldly, and I used to kind of take that attitude, but I don't want to put God in a box, and why should the devil have all our music? I want to know what you think about contemporary Christian music, even though I play hymns, but there is a rap song I heard called Amazing Grace by a group called God Quest, and I just feel that it's wrong that we shouldn't put God in a box when it has to do with Christian music, because it seems like prejudice or something, because they're different cultures, they're different races, they're different styles. And why should the devil have all our music? I want to know what you think about it.
Yeah, well, Luther said, why should the devil have all the good music, when he was criticized for putting Christian lyrics to popular songs. I would say that there's no genre of music that would necessarily be off bounds. As you say, different cultures have different styles of music. There are certainly some styles of music that are more offensive to the ears of certain people in culture. And therefore, if you're in a church with people young and old, it'd be best probably to confine the music to something that doesn't drive a segment of the demographic out of the church. I certainly don't see why Christian music should have to be boring or, you know, overly loud. I've been in churches, mega churches, from time to time, where they actually hand out earplugs at the door for any older people like myself who might not want their ears blasted. This is truly something that lots of mega churches do. They have a basket of earplugs for people. And I've always thought, well, one thing, you could save a lot of money if you just teach the sound man how to turn the knobs on the amplifiers, because then you wouldn't have to have music so loud that anyone needs earplugs. And I'm not sure what the advantage is of having music so loud that even they know that many people can't tolerate the volume. That's the thing. The fact that they hand out earplugs means they know very well this is offensive, this is unpleasant. A significant number of people coming to the church are going to find it painful. I think, well, when you're having a church service, presumably for a broad spectrum of worshipers, it seems like it is possible to have the music be something that doesn't drive people away. Now, I don't say it has to be hymns, and I'm not even saying that hip-hop or rap music can't be used for the glory of God, but of course, hip-hop or rap music would be very, very difficult to have congregationally singing. There are rap artists who are Christians who have Christian messages in their music. I don't object to that, although I don't care for rap music myself usually, but I can't find anything in the Bible that would forbid it. I think that when it comes to outreach, to use whatever style of music your intended audience listens to is a good strategy. But when it comes to church, where everyone's supposed to be worshiping together congregationally, music that's, pleasant, and I would add where the lyrics actually make some sense, would be something I would think any wise worship ministry would want to choose. But if you know people who say you shouldn't allow other styles of music than hymns in the church, well, I would disagree with that. Though, I would be very happy to go to a church where they only sang hymns, because the hymns, generally speaking, are much better quality in terms of lyrics and words than almost any modern music I've heard. I've heard some modern music that has really good words. It's funny because the ones I think have good words are the ones that sound the most like hymns. They're just modern, written by somebody imitating the style of a hymn, not the musical style so much as the lyric style. But, I mean, I'm not one of these get-off-my-lawn type guys who feels like if they don't play the music I like, you know, shame on them. I don't think anyone needs to play the music I like, but I do think that people who are choosing the worship music should consider, are these lyrics, do they make sense? Are they edifying? If there's any question about that, and I think there should be about much of the modern music, then I think they should just choose hymns. Who could object to those? I mean, all the hymns I know have something of substance to say. Anyway, that'd be my thoughts on that particular question. I appreciate the call.
Yeah.
I need to take a break right now. We have another 30 minutes coming up, so don't go away. The Narrow Path is listener-supported. And if you want to go to our website, you can see how to help us stay on the air if you'd like. TheNarrowPath.com is the website. That's TheNarrowPath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds, so don't go away.
As you know, the Narrow Path radio show is Bible radio that has nothing to sell you, but everything to give you. So do the right thing and share what you know with your family and friends. Tell them to tune in to the Narrow Path on this radio station or go to thenarrowpath.com where they will find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all the radio shows. You know listeners supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Share what you know.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith. This is not a bad time to call in. We have a few lines open, actually. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Before I take the next call, I should mention for those who regularly come to our Buena Park monthly meeting, which is the third Saturday of each month, you may not know if you haven't been listening to the show for the past couple weeks, I am out of town. I've been out of town all month, and I won't be home for, I guess, another week, something like that. So we're not having the Buena Park meeting this time. I apologize for that. We will plan to have it the following month. So if you're a Buena Park meeting attender, just want you to know that's been canceled this month. All right, let's talk to Michael calling from Inglewood, California. Michael, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for letting me speak again, Steve. It's kind of crazy because you were talking to Max a couple of callers back. And it's
Michael?
Crazy that he's kind of asking.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
There was a lot of wind on your phone. Are you outdoors in the wind?
Yeah, I just actually stepped. Let me step back in my car. I just stepped out of my car, and then I'll ask your question.
Go ahead.
Okay, so Max just asked the question. I think it had to do with John 21 and 23. I'm not sure if that's what you were talking about. But my question, I believe in Matthew, it's either 15 or 16, where he does kind of mention someone will remain until he comes back. So
it's chapter 16.
I guess basically my question. Uh-huh.
Yes, chapter 16 says, some of you standing here will not taste death until you see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom.
Okay, good. So considering that one and juxtaposed with John 21 and 23, it seems to me like somebody could still technically be alive until he comes back at the second advent, because I don't know if it shows how John the Apostle actually died.
Well, you're suggesting John may still be alive today?
Yes.
I don't think there's any reason to believe that. Jesus actually did not say that John would stay alive until he came back. In fact, there was a rumor in the first century that that Jesus had said that. And John 21 seems to be written to correct that rumor. It mentions that Jesus had been asked by Peter what would happen to John. And Jesus said, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you?" And then John the writer said, "And from this time on, a rumor went out that John wouldn't die, because they thought Jesus said that he would remain until Jesus came." But then he says, "But he didn't say that." The writer corrects that rumor. He says Jesus didn't say that he wouldn't die. He said that if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? So Jesus was making a hypothetical statement. If I wanted him to live until I come, basically that's none of your business. He's not saying I do want him to live until I come. And he certainly didn't predict that he would. So I don't think that the statement there in John 21:23 in any sense requires us to believe in something so amazing as that John would still be alive today somewhere. I would think if John was still alive today somewhere, first of all, it'd be an incredible miracle. But also, seems like he would appear. He would show up. Why would he hide? I think the church needs apostles now if they're available. Why would he not make himself available to correct the church of its errors and things like that? I think if John was alive today, I think the church would stand pretty much rebuked by him and hopefully corrected. But unfortunately, he's not available.
Well, I guess my main question, because I saw John before, but the Matthew one was kind of new to me. So then I was thinking maybe he was talking about somebody else besides John, or was when he returns and I think it says to his kingdom, what is him returning to his kingdom? Does that mean him riding to go to heaven when they saw him ascending after he was resurrected?
Jesus in that passage, which is, I think, Matthew 16:29, if I'm not mistaken, or 28. Jesus didn't use the word return. He said, some of you standing here will not taste death before you see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And if you read the parallels in Mark and in Luke, the same statement is found, but it's rendered a little differently. One of them just says, until you see the kingdom of God. And the other says, until you see the kingdom come with power. So it's worded a little differently each place, but in Matthew, it's until you see the Son of Man coming, which is an idiom commonly used in the Old Testament and also used sometimes in the New Testament about God bringing judgment, but not really literally God coming. A lot of times, for example, in Isaiah 19:1, when it's talking about the Assyrian armies judging Egypt, and this is a judgment that God is bringing on Egypt, it says the Lord comes with a swift cloud and will come into Egypt. That's fairly typical prophetic language, that when God sends armies to judge a nation, the prophets often speak of it as God is coming to judge them. He's not literally coming. That's a figure of speech. It's a metaphor. But I think that's what it means in Matthew 16:28. And there's other places where I think it's talking about the armies of Rome coming to destroy Jerusalem. So that'd be my understanding. I don't think he's predicting that anyone who was living then would be alive at the end of the world when Jesus returns. All right, let's talk to Gary from New Hampshire. Hi, Gary. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. I have a quick question regarding salvation. I heard you mentioned a while back that I heard you mention a few days ago why you thought someone may have never been saved to begin with. And I just heard Max, or I heard you speaking with Max, and he said he was a former evangelist. So the main question I have right now is,
actually,
why is
let me correct this. He didn't say he was an evangelist.
Yes.
He said he was an evangelical.
Didn't he say he was evangelical or something like
yeah.
that? I'm sorry. He didn't, wasn't he a believer at one time? That's what he said, didn't he?
That's what he said, yeah. But, right? but he didn't say he was an evangelist. Yeah, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I meant to say he was a believer at one time. So, mm-hmm. okay. So the main question I have is, why is it that some people, like yourself, myself, and other my brothers and sisters in the Lord now, that know they're saved, why is it that some people will say, yes, okay, and put and go through, you know, trust in the Lord, get saved, and claim that Jesus is the Lord, they're a sinner, the Romans 10, they know that we realize we're sinners, and Jesus Christ is the Savior of the world, and he died for our sin, and we need to put our faith and trust in him, take up the cross and follow him, so on and so forth. And why is it some people don't? In other words, there's not some kind of magical formula that says, okay, if you do this and that. So the bottom line, for the man with your experience, why do you think some people get saved and stick it through while others don't seem to be? And I heard that you made a good point. There are other Catholic and denominations where they claim to go to church. They say, we believe in Jesus and God, but where's the Jesus and God in their life? You made a good point.
Okay, so you want to know why some people who come to the Lord remain with the mm-hmm. Lord and others don't.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Well, okay, well, let me get to the answer then. You don't need to restate the question. Thank you. I don't know what causes that. I guess it's a little like asking why do some people keep their wedding vows and some people don't. It has a lot to do with their character, I'd say. It has a lot to do with their integrity. Some people care about their integrity and some don't. For example, people used to much more than now feel like it'd be better to stick with a commitment, even if it was inconvenient, costly, to keep their commitment, rather than to sacrifice their integrity by turning a vow they made into a lie. You see, when you make a vow and you say, I will stay faithful till death to your wife, well, of course there's temptations at times to do something else. Maybe you'd rather be single again. Maybe you'd rather have more privacy. Maybe you're attracted to somebody else. But those temptations simply have to be dismissed, because if somebody wants to be honest, they don't want to break their promises. Now, not everyone cares about being honest. I see it the same way with people who depart from Christ. When a person gets baptized, if they are a believer and they get baptized, they are promising something. They're saying, I'm committed to Christ now. I'm a Christian now. It's saying, I believe that Christ is the King. He's the Lord. I'm giving up my life of rebellion against him. I'm now going to be faithful to him. And that's a promise. So when somebody has been baptized in that way, and then they're tempted to do something else, maybe their friends think it's stupid to be a Christian. Maybe there's temptations to do things that Christians aren't allowed to do. Whatever. They're unpopular. They can't follow their own way anymore. They have to follow God's way. Under those kind of temptations, some people, again, they don't care about their integrity. They don't care that they promised something to God. They just want their way. And so I think some people care about their integrity and some don't. Some people want to keep their promises and some people really take that very lightly. And I've never understood why anyone would take their promises lightly, any promises. I mean, if I promise to do anything to anyone, I will certainly keep that promise if at all possible. And if something happens to prevent me from keeping it against my, out beyond my power, I'm really grieved, because I want to keep my promises. I want to maintain integrity. I think that if everyone in the world simply wanted to maintain their integrity, even if they weren't Christians, we'd have a much better world. But certainly Christians are committed to keeping their integrity. That is, to keeping their promises and not becoming a liar. But I think that some people don't mind making themselves liars, which is what you do when you make a promise to someone and then you decide not to keep the promise. That's simply saying, I don't mind being a liar. And people who have ever committed themselves to Christ and then fallen away have said, yeah, I don't care even if God thinks I'm a liar, because I am. I am a liar. So I think being a liar or being honest are the two choices for people who actually make commitments. They, they either are determined to keep them and will keep them, no matter how inconvenient it is, or they just cave in. And obviously, integrity is the same thing as character. So if somebody caves in on their integrity, they cave in on their character. They have weak character. They have people of poor character. A person of good character will keep their promises, obviously. And when someone says, well, I made this promise, but I won't keep it, what they're saying to anybody in their life is, I don't have good character. I don't have integrity. So, frankly, if I ever tell you I'll do something, don't count on it, because I don't really mind breaking my promises. So I think that's the main difference. Okay, let's talk to Pat from Connecticut. Pat, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for your strong stance in the last caller. I do appreciate hearing your take on things. Two things. The first one, very briefly, I was wondering how far do you go, how close do you get to the Northeast? I'm calling from Connecticut. And then I have a question after that.
Sometimes I get so close to the Northeast, I'm actually in it. I've been
to
Connecticut. I've been to Connecticut. I've been to Massachusetts numerous times, actually. I don't go there very often. It's just, the Northeast, New England states, there just haven't been that many opportunities. I generally go where I have an opportunity to go. But if you, what's that?
Okay.
Frankly, somebody just invited me to Massachusetts recently, and I might actually go there. But, the frequency with which I go someplace has a lot to do with the frequency with which I'm invited.
Well, I'll keep my eyes open and see when you're nearby. I think my husband and I would love to see you in person.
I would
too. My question is, yesterday someone called and was asking about the if God was timeless. And I was wondering how you would define timelessness versus eternal, if you thought that they were synonymous or how you felt they would be different. And at the time, you had only mentioned the verse concerning, as far as I remember, about God's idea of 1,000 years. What came to my mind was when God identified himself to Moses, he called himself I Am. The way I've come to understand that, maybe I haven't researched it as I should, but I came to understand I Am as being I was, I am, and I am to come. That's kind of, whether it's eternal or timeless, I'm not sure. I was wondering what you think about that.
Yeah, well, to say that God is eternal, some people think eternity is a realm, which is a different realm than time. That time is not just a slice out of eternity, but time is like a different realm than eternity. And that God doesn't live in time, he lives in eternity. And that, as C.S. Lewis put it, who thought this way, he said that if all of time was represented by a line drawn on a piece of paper, well, the piece of paper is God. That is to say, God is outside of that line, but contains it too. Now, that's just a man-made illustration that may not be true, but C.S. Lewis definitely was one who did talk about God being outside of time, and that everything was present to him. Now, I would say the pastor I studied under growing up took that view too. Yeah, he said that when God said, I am, he meant that God was in some timeless zone. It's always present for him. So he lived in kind of the eternal present, or eternal now, I think is the term we heard. Now, this is a possibility. We don't really know otherwise. But on the other hand, I'm not sure what that would mean or what it would look like or how we would grasp it. As far as I know, nothing in Scripture requires that we see eternity as a different realm If you simply extend time backward infinitely and forward infinitely, you have what I would call eternity, what I think the Bible could easily be understood to mean by eternity. A lot of times people say that before God created the universe, there wasn't any time. And I guess I'd have to say, please define time for me, because the way I use the word time, it doesn't mean measured time. Once clocks were invented and calendars and so forth, we had effective tools for measuring the passage of time. And even before clocks, I mean, there were sundials and things like that. Measuring the passage of time has been something that humans have done since the beginning. In fact, it says in Genesis 1 that on the fourth day, when he made the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, that he made these things for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. So they were. We see time begins to be measured on the first day when God says, "Let there be light," and then he divided light from darkness. So you end up having the first day and the second day and so forth. So you have time being measured. But the fact that you begin to measure something doesn't mean that it didn't exist before. For example, at some point, modern man figured out how to measure the speed of light. I still don't know how they do that. But before they had a way of measuring the speed of light, light was already moving at that speed for a very long time. So our ability to measure time isn't the same thing as the existence of time. I consider time, at least the way I use it and I think about it, which may not be correct, is simply the succession of events or the succession of moments, so that some things are earlier and some things are later. Now, if there was a time before God created the universe, that speaks of time. It was, you know, his existence was earlier than the creation of the universe. So it seems to me that it can't be the creation of the universe that began the succession of events, because it was an event. And I believe God existed before that. You can't create something if you don't already exist. So, you know, this is perhaps beyond my pay grade to understand time. It's a philosophical question.
But, well, thank you.
Yeah, so
thank
I don't
you
really
very
understand.
Much. Yeah, no, okay. Thank you for just expounding on that. I really appreciate it. I'll talk to you next time. Thank you. God bless.
Okay, Pat. Thanks for your call. God bless you. John from Portland, Maine. We got quite a few, actually, New Englanders. We got one from Massachusetts calling, too, if we can get to it. And another from Connecticut. We got four calls in a row from New England. Go ahead, John.
Excellent. Thank you, Brother Steve. I just want to take a quick moment to thank you and your staff for just facing all these issues and the general public. Ooh-wee. I wish we were all saved. Very quickly, I'm sorry, I've never called into a radio station before. Just back to the worship music, you hit it right on the head with edification. And no matter what genre or style of music we're listening to, is it glorifying God or is it glorifying oneself? And since I've been saved now 7 years, I have a deep passion for worship music and all music. And so what I see in contemporary Christian music, I'm sad to say, most of it can be self-glorifying, just the singer alone, just too much emphasis on self. I don't know. I can tell when the Holy Spirit moves and when music is anointed, and it is powerful and it is amazing and led me to my salvation. But
I understand what you're saying.
That's all.
I think there is a tendency in our culture generally to be self-focused and narcissistic, and we need to be careful not to allow that tendency to creep into our worship. When we're worshiping God, we're supposed to be looking outwardly, not inwardly at ourselves. There may be an appropriate time to look inwardly. Paul said, examine yourselves and see if you're in the faith. But when we're worshiping God, it's when we're supposed to be looking outwardly. Now, when you talk about self-glorifying, I think you've got probably two different things in mind. One of them may be the actual lyrics to the songs. A lot of modern Christian songs seem to talk a lot about how I feel and how God feels about me. And it's me, me, me. Not all of them are that way, but a lot of them are. And I do kind of, when I see that happening, it feels a little too narcissistic from my point of view. But then there's, of course, the performance of the music. A person leading the singing can either be attracting attention to oneself or try not to do so. I kind of like a cappella music. I don't mind, instrumental music. I'm not against it. But a cappella music's really beautiful if you have a congregation that knows how to sing anything and can hold it, carry a tune. But, maybe a guitar, an acoustic guitar or two to help keep people on the tune isn't a bad thing. But I've always thought that when somebody's playing an instrument up there, and that would include me, I'm a worship leader, and I mean, I have been. And I play the guitar to do it. But I always feel like when I'm listening to a musician playing worship, that if they play too flashy or too well, it distracts me. I notice how well they play. I become impressed by their musicianship. On the other hand, if they play so badly that they're playing the wrong chords for the songs and stuff like that, which I've heard that a few times, then it's distracting too. I think, I don't know, there must be a sweet spot there that a person plays well enough that you're not distracted by their mistakes, but not so well that you're thinking about what they're doing with their fingers, you know. But I think that perhaps in many churches, the aim these days is for the music to sound very professional. And being professional sounding is not necessarily, in my opinion, not necessarily a value that worship needs to be seeking to approximate. Thank you so much, John, for your call. Let's talk to Andrea from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrea. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi.
Hi.
So I just have a question regarding your end times theology and like what you believe, because I've been listening to a few of your calls, and for Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, those gospels were not written to us. We're the Gentiles. I'm not a mid-Acts dispensationalist, but I do divide the word of truth, right? You know, I rightly divide the word of truth and who, what, when, where, and why. And I understand that Israel has different promises than us. So, of course, in Israel, they're the ones that are going to, most of them are going to be the ones that see Jesus' second coming because they weren't in the rapture.
Well, let me jump in here before we run out of time. God did give different promises to Israel than he gave to us. It's true. It says in Hebrews that Jesus is the mediator of a better covenant based on better promises. But the promises God made to Israel, he fulfilled. Christ is the fulfillment of those promises. And so God fulfilled the promises to Israel, and then he made a new covenant with the people of Christ. And there are better promises there. I don't believe there's any unfulfilled promises to Israel. If you're interested in my theology about this, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Look under topical lectures, and there's a series there called When Shall These Things Be? If you listen to those lectures, they're free. When shall these things be? If you listen to those, you'll understand what I'm talking about. I don't have time to go into it now, I'm afraid, because I'm going to be cut off in just about 10 seconds. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener-supported. You can go to our website and see how to support us if you'd like. It's thenarrowpath.com. Have a good weekend, and let's talk again Monday. God bless you.